I think are amazed by what your body will do if you just keep telling it to do stuff. So, you know, your mind gives up a lot quicker than your muscles do, or at least it tries to. And if you can just stay, I suppose, if you can just stay mentally strong, you're going to get it done, essentially. We spent so much of that journey in so much discomfort, and there are so many points where we thought, well, this is it, especially me. Alfie did slightly better than me, especially on the hiking sections. So many points where I just thought, I want to give up. This is so uncomfortable. My feet hurt so much. I know how much more I have to do after I finish this section and how much more discomfort there's going to be. I just can't do it. But just what you can achieve if you just kind of push through, basically.
That was Oscar Scafidi, who joins us in the latest episode of the All Things Risk podcast to talk about kayaking the Kwanza River in Angola. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is the show all about risk and uncertainty via long-form conversation with great guests. We talk about decision-making. We talk about doing great things, overcoming biases, about the big risks of our time, and so much more. And I wanted to start this episode with something related to our guest and the topic of conversation, but it will take me a little bit of time to get there. So the background to this is that I'm a cyclist, as some of you know, and on a training ride on Saturday this week, a couple of days ago, a driver brushed my elbow with his wing mirror and nearly knocked me down. I remonstrated, and he stopped and started to yell at me, and I thought for a moment that he was going to drive his car into me. He was that angry. Instead, he pulled over, got out of his car, and he wanted to fight, basically. There was traffic. I really couldn't get away. I got off of my bike, because if I have to defend myself, I don't want to be on my bike. He started to push me. He had his fist clenched. He was ready to strike. A friend of mine who was up ahead had stopped and turned around. He went up to him, got very aggressive, and I thought for a second that the best thing to do at that point was to take this fine gentleman down with a rear naked choke or something like that. And at that moment, six cyclists were coming the opposite way. They stopped and started to join in the discussion, if you could call it that. But that kind of diffused the situation, and perhaps he felt outnumbered and he had a moment to think. And it calmed the situation down enough that he eventually went on his way. Now, I don't know what set him off like that. He thought that basically I shouldn't be in the road. That was clear. And there's a huge amount of hatred and ignorance towards cyclists and cycling in the UK, where I live, and other countries as well. And it's by a very small percentage of people. But that's not what I want to talk about. Basically, I felt that this man was carrying something that made him aggressive, and it set him off in a big way. And I think that we all do this in smaller ways. We might get into an argument with someone, and if we're not careful, it can affect our next interaction, and the one after that, and the one after that, and so on. And you might call it bad vibes. And in fact, I came across an article on this topic, the topic of bad vibes, which states that there's now some scientific studies that have demonstrated that actually there is such a thing as bad vibes, and good vibes, by the way. And what happens is we emit some chemicals that we can detect in one another, and I'll put a link in the show notes. So my point in all of this is that it's important to do what we can to see each situation for what it is, and not to take our bad vibes with us into the next one. And it also reminded me a story that comes from East Asia. Not quite sure the exact country. I think this story exists in a variety of countries, but basically it's two Buddhist monks who are walking, and they come across a river crossing, and there's a woman who wants to get across the river as well, but she's struggling. She has a large dress and couldn't get wet. And the older of the two monks decides to pick her up on his back and carry her across, and he puts her down on the other side of the river. And at the time, male monks were not allowed to touch women. I presume they probably aren't allowed to touch women nowadays either. I'm not sure. But the younger monk really couldn't believe what this older monk did. And they kept walking for over an hour or longer when he couldn't take it anymore. And he turns to the older monk and asks, "How could you have touched that young woman?" And the older monk replies, "I let that woman go at the bank of the river, but you're still carrying her." The point being, you know, that when bad things happen, don't project them any farther than warranted. And when good things happen, enjoy them. And that is particularly true if you're an adventurer. And that brings me to this episode, because this episode is about two young men that embody that ethos. And it leads to the conversation that I want to introduce. My guest is Oscar Scafidi. Oscar is a teacher, a travel writer, a political risk consultant, and an adventurer. Oscar has lived and worked in many countries in Africa. And in 2016, he and his friend Alfie Weston became the first people to kayak the Kwanza River from its source to the Atlantic Ocean. The Kwanza is the longest river in Angola. It's over 1,000 kilometers long. It's over difficult terrain. And it took Alfie and Oscar 33 days to complete the journey. And along the way, things did not go perfectly, as we will hear. They sunk their kayak, they were chased by hippos, and they even got arrested. And Oscar also talks to us about Angola and its history, the tragedy of civil war, and the legacy of landmines in the country, the work of the Halo Trust, which is the charity they did this for and with, and a lot more. Word of warning, I lost a few minutes of audio due to a connection issue, and during the conversation, I cut in to explain where that was, and we pick it up following that. But beyond that, I think you're going to love this. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Oscar Scafidi. Enjoy. Oscar, welcome to the All Things Risk Podcast. Pleasure to have you on. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So, Oscar, we were just talking about this, that in episode, I think it was 5 or 6 now, I interviewed Taryn Kent Hume, who kayaked the Amazon from the source to the Atlantic Ocean. And you've done the same now with the River Kwanza. And it sort of also strikes me that at some point, the land masses were joined together. So
I wonder specifically with Brazil and Angola. Yeah.
Exactly. So I wonder if you both have now gone from one source to the other source and have kind of joined up. So I'm wondering if we're joining up virtually at least joining up these two expeditions, which is very interesting.
Well, that sounds like Taryn did the larger proportion of the journey than we did. I think the Amazon's a little bit longer than ours.
Slightly, but you guys had a very interesting journey as well. And unlike Taryn, you guys got arrested. So that's great. And we'll talk about that. Well, I don't know if it's great, but it's great to talk about.
Yeah, it's great for the story. You're right.
That's right. Before we begin, though, I'd love to get a little bit more of your background and, you know, who you are and how did you find yourself in Luanda? What was it that took you there?
That's a good question. I suppose I was born and grew up in Italy. I studied in the UK. I did archaeology and history as my undergraduate degree, which doesn't really have many obvious pathways into the world of work. And I didn't really give much thought when I was at university to what I was going to do once I graduated. So I graduated and kind of found myself looking around for things to do. An opportunity came up to move out to Khartoum in Sudan to teach English at an international school, which was very, very strange that I'd seen this on a university notice board. I kind of, without giving it much thought, I signed up, and that was the first time I'd ever actually left Europe. and I moved out to Sudan and took a job out there and had an absolutely fantastic time, fell in love with Africa, and while I was there, met some really interesting other people who were teaching, and one of them lent me a book while we were working out there called Another Day of Life, which is written by the Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuściński. And it's basically the story of him in Angola in 1975 on the eve of independence, just as the civil war is breaking out. And I mean, I loved his writing style. I loved the story. And from the very first time I read it, I was absolutely captivated with the idea of going to Angola and finding out more about this place. So I suppose it appealed to me from the point of view of being a historian. And also, I was very keen to learn Portuguese and stay in Africa. So my options were pretty limited. If I was going to be working in a school and learning Portuguese, it was going to be either Mozambique or Angola. And I thought Angola sounded far more interesting, having looked at its history.
Yes, very, very cool. And I love it when people say that, you know, they didn't know what they wanted to be. Because I think that opens up the world of adventure. Most of the people that I've spoken to, you know, they have a similar answer to yours, which is very cool.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm not sure I'd quite recommend the pathway that I took. I was speaking a little bit with my friend Alfie, who did the kayaking journey with me. And we both had quite similar experiences. So I think he studied anthropology at university and did exactly the same thing as me, which is had no idea what he was going to do after he'd finished uni. But I don't think he was quite as worried about it as I was. So he thought that was quite a good experience to leave uni, then work it out as you go along.
Yeah, I taught English in Korea about when I left uni. This was over 20 years ago now, and it's a great experience, and it's we're very fortunate to be English speakers that there are opportunities around the world to teach the language we speak.
Yeah, in many ways, it's a little bit unfair, I think. My only qualification at the time was the fact that I was a native English speaker. I mean, obviously, since then, I've taken much more of an interest in the world of education and actually got qualifications so that I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was quite fortunate that avenue was open to me at the beginning of my career.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the country of Angola. And you read this this book, Another Day of Life, and what was it about Angola that kind of captivated you? So it's a country with a very colorful past, obviously, with the civil war and diamond mining and a range
that's
of other
right
things.
It's had a pretty troubled past. So I mean, it was a Portuguese colony, so unlike the French and British and other colonies in Africa, it was decolonized very, very late. So I mean, it was essentially an integral part of Portugal up until 1975, and then suddenly, or 1974 rather, then they suddenly decolonized over the course of less than a year. So, I mean, this was a place where colonialism lasted a good 15 years longer than it had done anywhere else across the continent. And just the transition they had from being under Portuguese rule to being independent was so fast and so poorly managed and resulted in so much violence. It's really quite unique across the whole continent. And then following that, they had a civil war all the way through to 2002, which sucked in a lot of the regional powers, had a Cold War aspect to it, with the Cubans and the Soviet Union getting involved on one side and the Americans and all their allies on the other, which made things so much worse. The fact that Angola is very mineral rich, especially when it comes to oil and diamonds, just seems to have fueled the conflict further. There's just been so much going on. It's been such a closed society for so long. I found that all very interesting. I really wanted to go over there and find out more about it.
And how long did you spend there before you said, right, we're going to do this kayaking trip?
Well, I lived and worked there for 5 years. I lived there from August 2009 until the summer of 2014. Mm-hmm. And throughout that entire time, it never would have occurred to me to do the kayaking trip. It wasn't until I'd actually left that my friend Alfie came up with this suggestion. So Alfie was still living and working there in 2015, and he found out that he was going to be leaving the country and being reposted to Hong Kong. And then he also found out that he'd have a gap between the end of his contract in Angola and the beginning of his contract in Hong Kong. So the whole kayaking trip was completely his idea. He decided he wanted to have
one last adventure before he left. He wanted to see the parts of Angola he hadn't seen before, and the more research he did, the more he realized that this might be a sort of a doable expedition.
Can we talk a little bit about the Kwanza River then, in light of what it means for the country of Angola?
Yeah, sure.
I take it, you know, it's a major artery. It's and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm presuming that in Angola infrastructure is, you know, is not the greatest, and so having a river there is you know, is a very useful thing to have for local people and local in the local economy.
But could you it's an extremely important. It's the longest river exclusively in Angola. It's very, very long, going all the way from the highlands down in the southeast, all the way out in a sort of northwesterly direction out into the Atlantic. It's in the same catchment zone as a bunch of other rivers that feed the Okavango Delta. So that kind of southeast area of Angola is extremely important from a biodiversity point of view. In fact, National Geographic have been sending expeditions down there for the past 4 or 5 years to collect information about that area. Which was quite useful for us because it meant we could speak to them about logistics on the ground in one of the least visited parts of the country. And yeah, you're right. It's been important since colonial times as a main sort of thoroughfare for moving people and goods in and out of the interior. There's a lot of colonial forts on the last sort of lower sections. And now there are also some quite large hydroelectric installations. Mm. So a lot of the electricity in the country is produced by places like Kapanda Dam, for example, which is where we got arrested.
Well, we'll get into that. So this idea, no one has up until now ever kayaked it. So is that was what drew one of the draws that Alfie brought forward? Was that?
I think so. I think the world first aspect definitely mm-hmm. appealed. Mm-hmm. Alfie already had a collapsible kayak called a klepper, mm-hmm. which he'd had in country anyway because he's quite into it. And his brothers came over to visit him once, and they did a sort of 200-kilometer section mm-hmm. of the lower stretches of the Kwanza River while his brothers were visiting. And I think off the back of that, he started thinking, wait a minute, could I expand this trip out to cover the whole river? And the more he looked at the satellite photography and spoke to people, the more he realized that the Kwanza is quite unusual for that part of Africa in that the vast majority of it is navigable. Mm-hmm. So you don't have huge sections of waterfalls or impenetrable rapids like you would do in a lot of other rivers around there. Mm-hmm. I think he started getting quite excited. I mean, he started planning the journey a good year before we actually did it. So right. The more he looked at it, the more he realized that this could actually be done on a sort of independent basis without a running support team.
Yeah. Okay. Very important. But you guys did it with this organization called HALO. Could you talk a little bit about who they are?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the HALO Trust are the world's oldest and largest humanitarian landmine clearance organization. They're based up in Scotland, and they've been working in Angola for many, many years, since before the Civil War finished, I think. Mm. And I mean, I'd already interacted with them on a number of times because while I was I'd been teaching while I was working in Angola at the international school in Luanda, and we used to do all sorts of fundraising events for the HALO Trust, so the students were quite closely involved in it. We taught all the kids about the terrible legacy of landmines in the country. And I actually had a close friend from school who not only worked for the HALO Trust, but he ended up getting posted out to Angola with the HALO Trust, which is rather unusual. So I actually met up with him a couple of times in country, and I was able to sort of be shown their facilities and what it was that they were doing down in the southeast, where a lot of the remaining landmines are. So yeah, we thought if we're going to do something this ridiculous, we might as well do it for a good cause. Mm-hmm. I thought, what better cause than the HALO Trust, essentially, especially as we're going to be kayaking through a lot of the areas that they actually work in. So we got in touch. They were very enthusiastic about it, especially as they're quite desperate for funding these days. So they've had a lot of their funding from international donors cut back at the moment, and they're struggling to find replacement sources of funding. So I think the HALO Trust aim is to make the world landmine free by 2025. Mm-hmm. So they've got about 7 years left on that. And I think they've got two countries that are of major concern. One of them's Afghanistan and the other one's Angola. Mm. So we thought, okay, let's try and raise money for them. And at the same time, given that we're going to be traveling through their areas, perhaps they could actually provide some support for the expedition as well, which they did, which was excellent.
Sure. And Angola is the one of the, well, it, how many landmines are there now in, or were there, and how many are still out there in Angola? It's over 100,000, something along those.
I think so. There are some pretty depressing statistics on the Halo Trust website talking about how many they've cleared already. They're also the only organization in Angola that's removing unexploded ordnance. Mm-hmm. And sorry, that's not true. They're the only organization collecting up unwanted weaponry and disposing of it, basically. So there's so much stuff left over from the Cold War. The country just got pumped full of this military equipment, and now they're sort of struggling to get rid of it quickly enough. There's a lot left to get rid of. I know, and especially in the rural areas, where there's been no sort of strong financial incentive or commercial incentive to get the landmines cleared. Mm.
And so you end up having, you know, I guess stories of people just walking in fields and stepping on them and, you know, losing limbs or worse.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wrote a travel guide to Angola back in 2013 for Brat Travel Guide. So I got to go to all 18 provinces in the country as part of that. And I traveled down to the southeast to Quando-Kubango province, right down in the southeast. And that's where one of the largest battles of the Angolan Civil War happened, which is the Battle of Cuito Carnaval in 1988. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that was the biggest tank battle since World War II in Africa. And yeah, I mean, you go down there and there are just, you know, there are Soviet helicopters and tanks and anti-aircraft guns, and just there's just the remnants of war scattered everywhere. You can still find soldiers' helmets just lying around. Mm. And those communities, they're so desperate for farmland. A lot of them are still sort of, they're still collecting firewood in active minefields, and some of them are still farming in them. So you hear about accidents all the time. So it's a little bit tragic that they're that desperate. They're that desperate for food that they're going, knowingly putting themselves in danger.
Yeah, that is absolutely tragic. I mean, you would have thought in this day and age that there'd be a way to, you know, to clear all of this stuff. As you say, I mean, it's a question of funding, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, the trouble is it's a very slow process. Mm-hmm. It's not a particularly technical process. Mm-hmm. I think when I was down there, they told me to train someone to do mine clearance. Doesn't actually take very long. I think it takes a few months, but it's just a very painstakingly slow process. So there's no cutting corners. You just need manpower and you need time. So it's just about getting the investment, essentially. So I think they actually put a figure on it for us. So our original aim with the journey was to raise $10,000 US, and that was enough to get one team of mine clearance workers to work for a month down in Cuito Carnaval. Mm. That's $10,000. Which is quite a lot of money considering how low the wages are in Angola. Mm-hmm. They need a fair amount more cash to get it done by 2025.
Yeah, it is quite tragic. But and the whole diamonds thing also plays into it, because did I read somewhere that you were also a risk consultant or political risk consultant, or have done some work in that space?
Yes, that's right.
All right, okay.
I also do political risk consultancy and security consultancy, I suppose.
Okay. So, no, we've got something in common then, because I've done that work as well. But you know, when you think about diamonds and oil and gas, and it comes back to this thing called the resource curse, and you know, whether or not countries that are endowed with natural resources, they're more prone to, you know, conflict and poor governance and all of this sort of stuff. So it's a bit, you know, you see that, I'm sure, right in the everyday, I imagine, and you see it in your film, diamond miners. You know, you've got this country that's, you know, resource rich, mineral rich, but yet is struggling with all of these issues.
Yeah, I think there's. I suppose it's controversial as to whether endowment with natural resources causes conflict in the first place. But I don't think there's much argument that when conflict happens in an area that's rich in natural resources, it tends to be exacerbated and lengthened and prolonged by the presence of those minerals. So, yeah, I mean, in the Civil War, you had one side, the MPLA, that had all the oil, mm-hmm. and you had the other side, UNITA, the rebels, mm-hmm. that had all the diamonds. And that paid for an incredible amount of weaponry and foreign expertise and that kind of thing, which dragged things on till 2002.
Right, right. Well, we can dive into that, but actually we're here to talk about your kayaking journey. So why don't we, but let's use risk to transition to that, because given what you were doing, how did you guys sit down and prepare? You said Alfie, looked at this for about a year. So what were the things that you had to bear in mind, and how did you pull this together? What was the preparation like?
So we were in a rather fortunate position in that when we agreed to do the trip, we're about a year out, and I was based in London and Alfie was based in Angola, mm-hmm. which meant we could sort of divide up responsibilities quite effectively. So obviously Alfie was doing the scoping out of the actual river, so driving down there at weekends, finding out, speaking to local contacts, talking about getting permits and dealing with the bureaucracy at the Angolan end. Whereas I was on the hunt for equipment, medical gear, sponsors, that kind of thing. But from a purely risk point of view, I think we had quite a lot of long conversations together about what are the main risks and how can they be mitigated, essentially. So I think the first thing we wanted to do was speak to people who had experience of those risks in that area before. So they're quite hard to hunt down because, as you can imagine, it's a very isolated part of a country that lots of people don't really go to in the first place. But we were very lucky in that National Geographic's Into the Okavango team had been going down there, at least down in the southeast, for quite a few years. So we're able to get in touch with Dr. Steve Boyce, who runs that expedition, and speak to him and find out exactly what was going on in terms of the dangers posed by hippos, crocodiles, other wild animals, that kind of thing, and ask what sort of strategies he put in place to mitigate those risks. So he was one person we spoke to. I've also got a couple of other friends who work in conservation down in the south of Angola who are also a huge help. And obviously the Halo Trust were a really useful resource because they also work in those rural areas and they deal with explosives, so they need to have proper casualty evacuation plans in place. So we spoke to them a lot about what happens if things go wrong in certain sections of the expedition. We certainly weren't able to mitigate all the risk, but I think we did about as much as we could, given the very limited budget that we had.
We'll get into that in a moment, but you mentioned a few things there that were on your radar. So hippos and crocodiles, right? So I hadn't really, until I watched your film, hadn't realized how dangerous hippos were or are.
Yeah, most people don't. To be honest, I only learned about it. I learned about it quite a long time ago, but the way I learned about it is when I was in Senegal, my friend and I went out kayaking. We borrowed some kayaks from a lodge that we were at, and we went kayaking. We kayaked right up to a hippo to have a look at it. And it was fine. It just kind of swam off. And then when we went back and told the lodge owner, I've never heard someone look so horrified. He was absolutely shocked that we hadn't sort of turned around and immediately sprinted away from it. And then he explained exactly how dangerous they are. And since then, it's always been at the back of my mind that they look like big, friendly, floating cows, but actually they kill far more people in Africa than any other dangerous animal. So, yeah, they're just very territorial, very, very quick.
Out of self-defense, right? Mm-hmm.
So they're territorial for their patch of the river, mm-hmm. so they fight a lot. They're also mothers are very sensitive to you going near their calves, mm-hmm. And the males are very sensitive to you going near their women. Mm-hmm. So, and they're fast. They can run faster than you can sprint, and they can definitely swim faster than we could kayak. So
I read that. That's amazing.
Yeah, they look big and slow, but actually they were definitely the biggest concern of the whole journey. Mm-hmm. Which was interesting. So the first thing we looked into was getting rifles because, mm-hmm. Without knowing much about it, that's the obvious solution is, shoot it.
Yes.
And we obviously that was going to involve quite a lot of bureaucracy in Angola. To legally get a rifle would be extremely difficult.
Right.
I mean, from a practical point of view, getting hold of a rifle, probably not very hard, but we wouldn't want to be stopped with a rifle that we didn't have the paperwork for. But having spoken to a few people, they all agreed that was a terrible idea. So they said, not worth the hassle. And if you're carrying, they said, by the time you realize you need a rifle, it's going to be far too late out on the water. So you'd need a very specialized round to shoot and kill a hippo. They're borderline bulletproof because they have so much fat on them. Mm. And you're not going to shoot a moving hippo from a moving kayak while it's coming to you. So the suggestion from everyone who knew anything about it was essentially you need to stay away from them, essentially, right. And don't surprise them, is what he said. And Steve Boys especially gave some really, really interesting advice, because he actually got attacked in his kayak and flipped out of the kayak by a hippo.
Wow.
In fact, one of them came very close to putting a tusk through his leg, I think. So he said they paddled past around 400 pods of hippos in their time on their expeditions, and they got attacked by the very first pod they went past.
Wow.
So you can imagine how stressed they were for the remaining 399 times. But yeah, he just said, essentially, he said, never surprise them, give them plenty of space to move away from you, which they generally will do if they're given the option. And just don't come between them and the bank if they want to get out, or them and the center of the river if they want to go and swim away from you. And that was generally good advice. So that's basically what we did.
Right. Because they'll bite. They'll use their, I guess they've got tusks and whatever else.
Yeah. So they'll look to. I mean, we spoke to a lot of fishermen who'd been attacked by hippos on the river, and generally speaking, they'll flip you out of the boat. Is the first thing they'll do, and then depending on how lucky you are, they'll then either drown you or bite you, or they'll leave you. I mean, it seems to be quite random. But yeah, we spoke to a fair few fishermen who'd been flipped out of their boat by angry hippos, and many of them had friends who'd been then killed by angry hippos. So, yeah. Okay. And of course, because they come from below, there's not much warning before you get bumped out.
Right. Yeah. So, and I presume you could get paranoid if you wanted to. Every little rock or every rock, that you go by, you think, oh, is that a hippo or not?
Exactly. Well, I mean, they're hard to see. They're designed so that only their nostrils and their eyes and their ears stick out of the water. And they really, given that there's a lot of sort of flotsam and jetsam floating around as you're going down a river, they're very, very hard to spot. In fact, the hippos that did attack us, we mistook them for rocks and paddled right towards them. And it was only because a local man shouted from the riverbank to warn us what we were doing, that we didn't go straight between them thinking they were stationary rocks, which definitely wouldn't have ended well. I mean, it almost ended quite badly as it was, and that was with warning. So, yeah.
Okay. So you heard about the hippos and you said, right, yep, no problem. We're still going ahead. What are the other things that,
Well, crocodiles are a more sort of traditional threat, aren't they? But we spoke to a lot of people about the crocodiles and no one was that concerned. They said, no, you've got to be far more worried about the hippos. They said crocodiles will generally give you a wide berth. And they don't tend to attack people in watercraft. They'll attack people washing on the side of the banks, and especially children. So as long as we were careful not to bathe at night in the river or go swimming ever, or fall out of the kayak, then they said we should be okay. Because generally they look up at the kayak and they tend to view it as another large predator.
Yes.
And given that our kayak was 5.5 meters long, that made us bigger than most of the, it made us bigger than all the crocodiles we saw. So they left us alone. I think we only saw a full crocodile on the bank once. Every other time they would slip into the water and swim away long before we arrived, which was quite nice. Because they're quite terrifying creatures.
Yeah, I can imagine. What about just basics like food and water?
Yeah, I mean, that was the biggest risk, was getting sick, getting far less exotic and exciting. But yeah, it was mosquito-borne diseases, and it was getting sick from dirty food or dirty water. So starting with the water one, there was no chance we were going to be able to carry enough water for each section of the journey. So we knew we were going to have to be drinking out the river, so we're going to have to purify our own water. So we spoke to a company, I think they're based in the UK, called Water to Go, who provided us with filtration bottles, which were excellent, worked very well. Rather unfortunately, partway through the journey, we lost those water filtration bottles.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, so one of them went overboard when we sank in some rapids, and the other one, I think we dropped it as we were dragging all our gear along through the jungle for one of the hiking sections, and we didn't notice till a lot later. I spent a good hour going back to try and find it, but it was gone wherever it went. So we had to use our backup systems, which weren't quite as good, and that gave us real issues with getting enough clean, safe water. We got so desperate at one point that we went into our real emergency supply, which was using chlorine tablets on the river water, which tastes disgusting, but gives you clean water much more quickly than the backup filtration device that we were using. So yeah, water wasn't much of a concern. Food, far more so. We essentially had to carry all of our own supplies for the whole journey. We then spoke to the Halo Trust about getting a couple of resupplies as we went along. Mm-hmm. I think in the end we got 2 resupplies in total over the course of the month. The plan was to get 3, but our wires crossed slightly and we missed out on on one of our resupplies. So yeah, I spent a long time in London before I flew out dehydrating food, essentially. So I bought a dehydrator and a vacuum sealer and just made our flat completely stink for a month. squashing things down and turning them into expedition rations, because this was much, much cheaper than buying them pre-made. Mm-hmm. So I became a bit of an expert at packing as many calories as possible into a smaller space as possible.
Right. Okay. And so anything sort of calorie dense foods, that's what you were dehydrating, I presume?
Yes, essentially. Yeah. So I found out how to make all sorts of different leathers, they're called, which is basically just mashed up fruit or vegetable sort of biltong, I suppose. So I made a lot of pumpkin leather and added extra sugar and honey and things. Mm. I dehydrated all sorts of random meals like chili con carne and bolognese. I even dehydrated those seafood sticks that you find, which are pretty disgusting to begin with.
That's
they're
right.
Definitely disgusting after you've rehydrated them, but yeah. It was all welcome food.
Yeah, it gave you variety as well, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. We were desperate for variety. Yeah. One of the things that we did quite well on, because we were actually able to find in some of the diamond mining camps as we were going along, was chorizo. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We ate an unhealthy quantity of chorizo on the journey, but it was very welcome just to get a change from what we were eating normally. And my girlfriend gave us some little Nutella sachets and Marmite sachets.
Oh, right on.
Which went down an absolute storm whenever we were eating those, because anything to add flavor.
Right on. And I guess maybe to round off the kind of things that you were worried about, you mentioned diseases or mosquito-borne diseases. So I presume as well, you know, geez, you're out in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, if you come down with malaria, that, you know, that could be pretty, that could get pretty nasty.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we had malaria testing kits, mm-hmm. and we were taking prophylaxis to make sure we didn't get malaria in the first place, and we had the treatment for if you did get malaria. But something like that, I think that would have ended the expedition, essentially, because you can't just – we're on a very tight schedule. We couldn't sit there and recuperate for a week while we waited to get better. And dengue would have been worse, actually, because dengue is a lot harder to treat, and it takes a longer time to get over. So that was a big concern. But I think more so than that – I mean, the more life-threatening things, like we did actually have to speak to the Halo Trust about the threat of landmines in some of the areas that we're going to. Stepping on a landmine would have been a bit of a disaster. Mm-hmm. Drowning was a big one we thought about, spending a lot of time out on the water. So a lot of exposure to risk in terms of rapids and waterfalls. Mm-hmm. But even something not that serious, like a badly broken leg, you know, we were very, very isolated. That would have been an extremely difficult thing to deal with effectively. I mean, neither Alfie nor I are medics. So I've done a couple of sort of bodge courses from people who know what they're doing about bush medicine, basically. And we had a fair amount of quite hardcore drugs and equipment with us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in a real medical emergency, it would have been very, very difficult to evacuate. So we mapped it out. So we knew where the Halo Trust 4x4s could get to. Mm-hmm. And get us out of. And we also knew we had a bush pilot back in Luanda, and there were a couple of sort of bush landing strips that he could get to. But I mean, help was a very, very long way away if we did have an emergency. And that was always in the back of our minds whenever we're thinking about what should we do about this particular set of rapids or climbing down this set of rocks. We had to be very, very careful.
Yeah. I can imagine. Did you have a satellite phone with you, or?
Yeah, we had 2 satellite phones actually. Although one of them was completely useless. We had a Thorion satellite phone that was excellent. So what we did is we texted our GPS locations every night when we set up camp. Mm-hmm. So we sent one off to an automated system on our website, which would update our little tracker. So we had a map on the website that sort of followed us along the river, so that everyone could follow us in essentially real time. And then we texted our locations to the Halo Trust, had a designated person waiting for our text message every night. So they knew essentially if there was an emergency or if we vanished, they'd know roughly where we were a few hours prior to that, so they could send help.
Cool. Cool. Well, it sounds like you had a lot of good preparation there. So that's it's quite essential. So I think you could probably over prepare, or you can think about these things to ad infinitum, but at some point you just have to do it, right?
I think so. I think you just have to decide, as long as you have a clear idea of the risks, then you can make an informed decision as to whether you're willing to accept that level of exposure. And I guess both Afi and I were pretty happy that we weren't going into it blind. We knew it was going to be pretty risky, but we'd quantified those risks as best as we could. And so you could spend a lot of time getting stressed about it.
That's great, and it sounds like that gave you a level of confidence and comfort and the ability to go ahead. So let's talk about the journey now. So you started at the source, and I hadn't realized how cold it gets in the evenings in that part of the world.
Neither had we. So it was very hard to get accurate weather data that isolated part of Africa. And I mean, the nearest city to where we were starting was a very long way away. So based on that data, we thought, okay, it's going to go down to 5 degrees, perhaps, maybe a little bit lower, perhaps down to zero. But no, it went well below freezing. Wow. That night. So we had some really uncomfortable nights because we didn't have the sleeping bags or the cold weather equipment. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was really, really uncomfortable for the first week. And it was quite tough to get up at 4:45 in the morning before the sun had risen and know that we were just going to be out on a freezing cold river in the fog for hours on end, cold and wet. It wasn't great for morale at the beginning of the journey, no. But I guess we could have done some more careful research on that front.
But it warmed up as the day progressed, right? In those early days?
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. My centigrade at night, or up to about 30 degrees C when we're out in the middle of the day. So we'd start off wearing basically everything we owned, and then we slowly strip off. The sun came out.
And how did you manage to damage the kayak?
Yeah, I think within 10 days we managed to sink the kayak, which wasn't a good move.
So unfortunately, but also perhaps coincidentally, we lost the connection right at the point where Oscar was describing how he and Alfie sank the kayak in some rapids. And we pick it up with Oscar talking about how he, Alfie, and a number of locals were trying to recover as much of their gear as possible.
Survived. It's quite good because there's a bunch of fishermen and kids further downstream who had kind of thought this was hilarious, fishing all of our gear out of the river and then walking down the banks with it to give it back to us. So we didn't actually, we got a lot of stuff back, broken and waterlogged, but some of it just went never to be seen again. So yeah, we lost an iPad that we're supposed to be collecting bird information for the Wild Bird Trust on. We lost my boots. We lost a lot of food and other stuff. Yeah, it was a total disaster.
Jeez, yeah. Sorry to hear that, but you managed to get it fixed. I saw with the help of a local carpenter. So that was a bit fortuitous.
Yeah, that's right. Luckily for us, only about 2 kilometers down the river, there's a huge diamond mine. They're digging diamonds off the riverbank. So the manager heard what had happened and came up and asked us if we were okay, and then offered to drive us to Kamakupa, which is the nearest town. And incredibly hospitable of him, he let us stay in his house for the night. He hooked us up with a local carpenter to do the repairs, made sure that people in town helped out. It was absolutely fantastic. So yeah, it was only actually led to a 24-hour delay, I think, which is pretty incredible considering the damage to the kayak.
Yeah, yeah. Quite fortuitous. And did you ever, in some of these expeditions, every time I've spoken to people who've done this sort of thing, and similarly, whenever I've also traveled, you run into these moments where it's the kindness of strangers that you all of a sudden you come across, and somebody who you don't know, who you probably will never see again for the rest of your life, helps you out in a very difficult situation. So I'm just wondering if this was one of those cases or maybe another one.
No, definitely that. I mean, that stood out. But there was almost everyone we met was so supportive, and that you're right. There was no reason for them to be. They were never going to see us again. But yeah, everyone was really enthusiastic about the trip. They wanted to hear what we're doing and why. And then, you know, when they heard what we're doing, there's always the same sort of set of questions. It's that, you know, isn't it dangerous? Don't you think you should be more careful? But then it was sort of, okay, if you're going to do it, how can we help you? How can we help you do it? And one guy in particular stood out for us. We did a huge walking section. I think it was about 32 kilometers of walking, carrying all the gear. And this is after I'd lost my boots, so my feet were in a complete state. And it was just, you know, really hard work, really depressing, just having to walk with a load of weight on your back. And we came into this town very late at night, and this Mauritanian diamond merchant was just sort of stood on his porch in, everything was dark. His house was the only one with light. So we assumed it was the police station and we walked towards it because we thought we'd tell the police we were there. Otherwise they might get upset. Always a good idea to register your presence with the police in these places. So we wandered towards the light. And when we arrived, we realized it wasn't the police station. We asked, where's the police? And the guy's like, oh, don't worry, I'll send someone to go and fetch the police. You guys look tired. Grab a seat. Let me get you some biscuits. Would you like a drink? This kind of thing. He's just so hospitable. And I remember he had a satellite TV on in the background, which is a bit unusual for quite a simple building there running off a generator. And he was watching France 24, and it was talking about Brexit. And we proceeded to have a big, long conversation about which way the Brexit vote was going to go. And he was so intrigued by it. He thought that was so interesting. And that just really stood out that he was such a friendly guy at just the right time. Cause we were in such a bad state after having walked all that way, really hot, really uncomfortable. And he just helped us out. It was fantastic.
Yeah. It's amazing. And that I imagine that experience just as you describe it, you know, it really sticks out for you. It's very clear, and you can, I'm sure that you probably never really forget that.
No, not at all. He even said we could stay with him for the night. We didn't in the end because we were able to camp, but yeah, he was incredibly hospitable. And all along the way we had exactly the same experience. Coming back to this question of risk at the beginning, one of the biggest risks that people pointed out to us was the diamond miners themselves. So a lot of these people are illegally or quasi on the but I mean it's a bit of a free-for-all, especially in the isolated section. So a fair amount of them have guns. A lot of them aren't actually Angolan, they're in the country illegally from other parts of Africa. And a lot of people we spoke to said, you know, whatever you do, don't go near these guys, they are the biggest risk, you know, they're bandits basically. But it was really refreshing to find that actually that couldn't have been further from the truth. All the diamond miners we met were awesome guys, really welcoming. You know, they let us camp near their encampments. If they had shops, they let us buy stuff from them. Usually it was only soft drinks and things, but such a refreshing change from drinking filtered water out of the river. They're all absolutely fantastic. So again, it was a really unexpected but pleasant surprise as we were traveling.
That's one of the wonderful things about travel. But you know, you're the first, you know, group of people, you know, two people, first people ever to do this sort of thing. So I can imagine the initially, you know, people are quite perplexed and, you know, you're doing what and why are you doing it? And, but it opens up a conversation, doesn't it? So it's, you know, it's great to have that, you know, that rationale for why you're doing it. And,
I mean, a lot of people really didn't understand why we were doing it. I mean, at the beginning of the journey, they just thought we were being ridiculous. Obviously, like, you know, you know, there's no way you're going to finish that trip. That's really stupid. And then the further through it we got, the more incredulous people became and sort of like, no, there's no way you started there. That's so far away. We got the question a lot, where's your engine? And we'd always get a good laugh by pointing to our biceps and saying, there's our engine. Yeah. And they were like, oh, and one guy seriously asked, like, do you want me to get you an engine? Because it'd be a lot quicker if you had an engine. So they couldn't quite wrap their head around this idea that we were putting ourselves in this uncomfortable situation essentially for fun. They didn't quite get this idea of raising money for the charity. They understood who the head of the trust were. Almost everyone does in that part of Angola. But they were like, okay, so you work for the Halo Trust? And we're like, no, not really. We're just raising money for them. It's quite hard to, I think quite a lot of that was lost in translation.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of that is lost in translation, even if you speak to native English speakers, right?
You know, yes, there's a lot
that couldn't fathom doing what you're doing or why you're doing it. But I was speaking to another potential guest yesterday, and he's a rock climber, and he was talking about, well, when I'm, you know, kind of free climbing and I'm on the face of a mountain, you know, I'm as alive as I will ever be. you know, I have to be right there, present, knowing what it is I'm going to be doing next. And it, you know, it strikes me that, you know, that whole journey, that sort of 33 days, you're pretty much in that kind of space, the good and the bad.
I think so. I mean, it was just awesome to have nothing to worry about apart from what's in front of you that day. It's quite simple, and no mobile phone, no constant social media or WhatsApp updates, no Wi-Fi or 3G, to just be, okay, today we need to paddle 70 kilometers and not get attacked by hippos. That was about it. It was really refreshing. It took a long time to reintegrate back into living in Europe after coming back. I'm not sure we wanted the trip to last longer, because we were desperate to finish, because it had just been such hard work. We're so uncomfortable, all these injuries. I mean, we're very excited to get across the finish line, but it took a while to switch from that mindset to the living back in civilization mindset once we got back.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you show some of those injuries and discomforting moments in your film, which I'll, you know, I'll link to in the show notes. But the one that you bought these Nike shoes that were a size too small or something, because you lost your boots in the, you know, when you lost the kayak. But as an example, right?
And I mean, I could make a whole separate documentary about the mission to find me a pair of shoes after I'd lost my boots. I think we went through about six pairs of shoes.
Wow.
After I'd lost my boots. Because, so the boots went overboard. And after that, I had to, I got a pair of trainers from someone. But for some reason, even though a lot of Angolan people are very tall, very large, that no one has very large feet. So, I wore a pair of shoes that were a size too small and did a sort of 20-kilometer hike. Immediately got blisters on both feet, and then it just got worse and worse over the course of the next few weeks, because obviously there's no opportunity to rest, and you know, feet are constantly wet, constantly sweaty. I think I went through four, five, six pairs of shoes. So whenever we're camping in a diamond mine or whatever, the first question I had for them is not, do you have any food, but like, do you have anyone with big feet? So I bought a pair of army boots off a guy in a military base. I bought a pair of fake Armani loafers from a guy in this other, which were comfortable in the evenings, but obviously not great for hiking because they didn't even have laces. Jeez. I went through all sorts. My feet were a bit of a hassle. I'm sure Alfie got sick of me complaining about it, but looking back on it, it was quite amusing. But at the time I was very, very unhappy. And that was one moment I showed in the documentary, actually, was when I actually showed my feet before we did a 32-kilometer hike. My feet were just a disgusting mess. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I might as well get something good out of this. This will be an interesting section for the documentary, at least. So I sort of filmed myself at 6 a.m, patching up my feet before we went walking. And that was just utterly, utterly horrendous. I don't want to go into too much detail, but I could hear them. I could hear them while I was walking, sort of squelching away. That was not good, especially when you've got a huge pack on your back pressing down on them.
Yeah. How much hiking was there compared to kayaking?
Alfie planned it out quite precisely, actually. Mm-hmm. So we knew in advance how much hiking there was going to be. In the end, I think the whole journey was 1,300 kilometers, and we kayaked 984 kilometers. So the rest of that was hiking, like 300 and a bit. Mm-hmm. But it was broken into different sections. There was slightly more hiking than we thought there would be. The big hikes were where we expected them to be. And the longest hike we had to do in a day was 32 kilometers, I think. But at the beginning of the journey, we had to hike a good 55 or 60K before we could get to a point in the river that was big enough to start kayaking.
Right, right.
And then, rather unfortunately, we actually entered the river far too early. we asked the local guys, like, where's a good point to enter? And they said, oh, here. And it looked great because it's quite wide and deep and fast flowing. So we got in and then got sort of 2 kilometers, and then it just degenerated into marshland and just impenetrable swamp. And then we had a big discussion as to, okay, do we now start hiking again or do we try and push through? And in the end, we pushed through, I don't know if that was a good move, but we gave that a go. But yeah, a fair amount of hiking and quite a lot of heavy equipment to be dragging with us as well.
Yeah, so it's not just, you know, it's not just going for a 32-kilometer, you know, long run or something. You guys are carrying all your gear.
Yeah, so we had 110 kilos worth of gear in total at the beginning of the journey. Yeah. When I left Angola, bizarrely actually, when I arrived in Angola, I inherited a trike buggying setup from someone just because it was so impractically large, they couldn't take it out of the country with them. So this thing lived in my flat for 5 years. It's basically a trike with a sort of bucket saddle. And presumably how it worked is that you attached a kite surfing rig to yourself and dragged yourself along a beach.
Okay.
We never used it for that. But anyway, Alfie customized this. So he got this cut into sections and welded so that it could be dismantled. And we brought that along so that we could drag our gear on that as we went along. So yeah, the first 60K, we did that. But for later sections, we actually had to dump the trike because it was too wide.
Oh, sure.
When you're going through sort of single track in the jungle, we basically had to have it on our back. So we then had to dump the trike and get rid of a fair amount of equipment and then just get the klepper on our backs, basically. And that was the harder sections when it came to hiking.
Logistically, I mean, so many moving parts logistically. Wow. That even that is impressive. I mean, you have to have a project management background to sort it all out, I suppose.
Well, we had this incredible series of Google spreadsheets where we wrote down what kit we needed and had the weight of each piece in minute detail and then worked out. We set ourselves a maximum each of how much we were willing to carry on our backs. Which I think we set it at 25 kilos each, and then that kind of went out the window quite quickly because that was unrealistically light. But yeah, we at least tried to be careful about what we took and what we didn't. I think after the sinking, our job became a little bit easier because we lost an incredible amount of gear in the river, never to be seen again. So that lightened our load. And we also got rid of a lot of filming gear after that because we thought, the drone is a waste of space. It's heavy. It's not being used enough. We'll get rid of that. And likewise, we're carrying a lot of electronic equipment we probably don't need.
Yes.
So we stripped down to, we tried to lose a fair amount of weight at that point for the second 2/3 of the journey.
Yeah. Yes. We've bounced around a little bit, and that's fine because I think people can go online and look at your documentary and, get a little bit more of a flavor for it. But one of the things I did want to cover was your getting arrested and how that, what was that all about?
Yeah. So I think in the planning stage, of all the reasons that the journey would have ended prematurely, we would never have thought that getting arrested would be on the list. What happened was I'm not saying this to blame Alfie. Alfie was in charge of sorting out our permits to do this journey before we went. Because Angola is a very, very bureaucratic country. I think they've inherited a fair amount of the bureaucracy from Portuguese. And we both had visas to be in the country. So technically speaking, we didn't need anyone's permission to go anywhere in the country. You know, we should be allowed to swim in the river, kayak in it, go wherever. As long as you had a visa, that's fine. In reality, though, that's not the way things work. And we knew that we were going to meet overly officious security forces and police who were going to say, wait a minute, where's your permit to do this? So Alfie spent months getting us reams of paperwork from the Ministry of the Environment, from the Ministry of Tourism, from the Ministry of Interior, saying, here's what we're doing, and, you know, is this okay? And we got like an 11-page document from one of the ministries saying, yeah, this is all fine. And even with all that paperwork, it all went wrong. So we were kayaking next to Kapanda Dam, which is the massive hydroelectric installation that powers a lot of Angola cities. And we actually went past it. So obviously not safe to go kayaking near a dam. So we went past it and camped in a village that was about 10 kilometers from the dam. And when we stopped at the village and we said, you know, is it okay to camp here? They said, yeah, yeah, sure. And we said, is there a police post where we can register? And they said, yes, let's get them on the phone. They're up in the town. So we tried to phone them, but there's no mobile phone signal. And they said, look, don't worry, it's late. You guys camp. Tomorrow morning, we'll walk you up the hill and you can register with the police. And we said, yeah, no problem. So we cooked up a load of fish, hung out with the people in the village, and then went to bed. And then next thing we know, around midnight, there's, you know, you hear a bunch of people stomping into the village, asking where we are, tents unzipped, AK barrels in the tent, people grabbing in, pulled us out, handcuffed us, said, we're under arrest. Wow. not a very pleasant way to be woken up. It went slightly better for me than for Alfie because I'd gone through my usual evening routine of unbandaging my feet. So my feet were looking absolutely disgusting, like, you know, pus and blood and whatever. So as I knew what was happening as well. I could hear, and I knew that, okay, this is the police being stupid, but it should be fine if we cooperate. So, you know, the barrel comes in the tent, then a hand comes in the tent with handcuffs, and I just kind of shoved my feet out the tent in their faces and said, look, you know, I'm not going to run anywhere. You can see I'm not going to run anywhere, so please give me some space. I'll put some clothes on and I'll come out. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, well, kind of disgusted by my feet. Whereas Alfie, I think, had been, you know, in a deeper sleep or perhaps, and he misunderstood the situation. He thought we're getting robbed, basically. Mm. So he thought that the guys weren't police at all. They were just guys with guns, which could have happened. So he was resisting. I think he grabbed one of the barrels and pushed it out of the tent. And so they were a little bit more rough with him. They actually dragged him out and kind of hit him and put their knees in the back of his neck and things to handcuff him. So he got it a little bit rougher than I did. But yeah, both got handcuffs. And I think what happened was it was just, you know, those were the police who were in charge of guarding the hydroelectric dam. They got overexcited. I think I don't know if they genuinely thought we were spying or if they just felt a little affronted that we hadn't asked them for permission to camp there before camping there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, either way, it didn't matter. You know, we were in their turf. We hadn't played it by their rules, and they decided that we were under arrest. So they took us up to the police station and chucked us in the cells for the night, basically. And, you know, no matter how much paperwork we kept waving at them and saying, you know, this is what we're doing, we have permission, they just weren't willing to listen. And that was the beginning of a 4-day saga that almost saw us deported.
Wow. Yeah. And so how did you almost get deported?
Yeah, well, we were absolutely, it was very Orwellian the way things escalated and how people just weren't listening to what we were saying. So we thought, okay, to be honest, being in the police cell wasn't actually that bad. In fact, slightly better than my tent, because my tent was very uncomfortable and wet. So I was like, okay, make the best of a bad situation. Let's get a good night's sleep. In the morning, we'll show them the permits. They'll apologize. They'll let us go. We'll keep going. That is not what happened at all. So the police commander phoned in that he'd arrested us to his regional commander, who's in a town called Melange, which is about 150 kilometers east of there, back the way we'd already paddled. Police commander says, okay, bring them to me. And we obviously did not want to do that because we just paddled that distance, but they weren't willing to negotiate. So they drove us all the way to Melange. We got there, and the police commander there was even more upset than the previous one that we hadn't asked his permission to paddle on his section of the Kwanza River, I think was his exact wording. And, you know, where are your permits? And we showed him the permits. He's like, these aren't the correct permits. Why didn't you speak to me before doing this? You know, and, you know, in as polite a way as possible, we tried to explain that he wasn't important enough for us to contact. You know, we didn't even know who he was. He was a town's police commander. Why would we be in contact with him when we'd spoken to the Ministry of Interior, the Ministry of Environment? But he just felt like our presence was almost an affront to his authority, and he wanted to make an example of us. So, he said the very first time we met him face-to-face, we were very apologetic, like, look, there's been a big misunderstanding, but we're doing this for charity. Please, can you let us go? I think his first words to us were, let me tell you right now, gentlemen, your journey, your expedition is ending here. That's what he said. And, you know, there's not much meeting in the middle when someone takes that kind of attitude. So he registered an official complaint against us with the Ministry of the Interior, filed a load of criminal charges against us. We spent the next 2 days being interrogated by his men and a bunch of people from the Serious Crimes Division. And wow. The whole thing was so bizarre, so we went, they didn't really understand why they were interviewing us, and we didn't understand what was going on. And so we gave a bunch of statements. They wouldn't give us access to
there was never any suggestion we have access to lawyers or anything, but they wouldn't give us access to the embassies or whatever. Jeez. And eventually we got the British embassy on the phone and we got the Italian embassy and they were like, okay, we'll sort this out. And we thought we'd then get released then, but no, they, wow. He had a final trick up his sleeve, which was he wanted to send us back to Luanda, the capital city, which is 400 kilometers in the wrong direction, back where the whole journey had started, basically, in the capital city. So he sent us back there. And then when we got there, we were rearrested, taken to an illegal immigrant processing center, and basically told, right, we're deporting you, essentially. So no one ever explained what crime we'd committed or why we were sort of being treated. It's very, very strange. Very strange. And no one we spoke to seemed to be the one responsible. Like, look, I've just been told to do this. It's not my fault. Like, you know, orders from higher up, this kind of thing. And we still, to this day, don't know why we were released. We have no idea. We know we got the Italian embassy involved because I'm a dual citizen and the British embassy. And through some sort of series of contacts, they managed to speak to the right person. And I know that I don't know if it was the Minister of the Interior, but it was certainly someone very important, because the whole boss of the processing center there, who'd been treating us not particularly well while we're in custody, he got a mobile phone call suddenly, and his whole body language changed. You know, he used to stand up to attention. He kept saying, yes, chef, yes, chef, yes, chef. And then within 2 minutes, he was like, right, guys, here are your passports, get their gear, these guys are leaving, you know, they're free to go. Wow. So it's pretty bizarre. We don't know what happened, we don't know who pulled the strings or who said what, but we got released. And I just remember when we got released, the responsible party at the British Embassy, he just said to us, look, guys, even I don't entirely understand what happened there, but you need to keep your heads down. Like, whatever you do, don't go back out on the river, because that's just going to upset them. So we sort of just kept quiet, and then 24 hours later, straight back out onto the river. There's no way we were going to stop. So yeah. we went back out and kept quiet to finish the journey.
Yeah, you had to go back to where you left off, right?
We did, which in itself was a bit of a risk, because obviously that's driving straight back into the into the area of the guy who hated us most. So yeah, once we did that, we flew under the radar. So we stopped sending text message updates to our tracker map. Mm-hmm. We stopped, we told my brother, because my brother was running the Twitter campaign at the time.
Right.
We told my brother to send out a load of messages on Twitter and Facebook that we'd had to pause the campaign and we were waiting in Luanda to decide what to do next, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All the while, we were actually back on the river trying to finish as quickly as possible. and we really were, the last section was a bit bizarre because we were rushing to finish, but also, it was almost like some sort of weird undercover mission. So we were camping, we're making sure we camped away from settlements, camping only, stopping when it was dark and then leaving before it got light so no one saw where we were camping. Whenever people asked what we're doing on the river in the last sections, we just told them, well, we're out fishing for the day, then we're going to go back to Luanda, that kind of thing. So all these kind of countermeasures we had to take to make sure that someone didn't come back out on the river and say, wait a minute, haven't we arrested you already? What are you doing back here? But yeah, really bizarre to be treated that way when I don't really think we did anything wrong. No. So.
And you still don't understand what exactly it was, did you?
No, I mean, we got some hints when we were in Melange. One set of people said they joked about it, but I don't think they're joking. They said you guys must be smuggling diamonds. They were really uncomfortable with this idea that we'd been through sort of the heart of the diamond area, and yet we weren't interested in diamonds. And again, when I say this, the idea of the journey was lost in translation. It was particularly lost in translation with these security forces. Mm-hmm. So, we said, look, you've got all our gear. Check it. Check the whole lot. Check it for diamonds. There are no diamonds anywhere in there. No evidence we've got diamonds. They kept asking, who's paying you to do this? Mm-hmm. Who do you work for? Why are you doing this? Like, how is it? The police command kept saying, how are you making money from this journey? Mm-hmm. We said, well, no, actually, we're losing money on this journey because, we've had to pay for all the gear. And he just didn't believe us, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. So that was one half. A few others, I think they were still hung up on the idea that we were near the dam. And again, they were like, that's a site of strategic interest. You're not allowed to go near the dam. Like, well, we weren't that near the dam. And, that's a slightly wartime mentality there. Like, we are allowed to go near the dam. There's a road right near the dam. Mm. If we want to, we could basically drive up to the dam with our visas and it's all fine. But they, I think they're a little bit paranoid. Again, a hangover from having had a civil war for so long, because during the civil war times, that was a hotly contested area, as you can imagine, because you can basically turn off the power for a lot of the cities by controlling the dam. Mm. So a lot of fighting over it. But that was a good, you know, that was almost 15 years before our journey started. So I would have thought they would have moved on from that kind of mentality.
Well, that, I guess it takes a long time, right? When culturally, you know, all the practices revolve around that. And you guys were the very first to have done this. So first they've
seen
it.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, Alfie and I, we tried to stay calm as much as possible. And also, we tried to remind ourselves that, yeah, the context is very different to what we used to. And even with that bad experience, I'd still say that, you know, 99% of the people we met, even security forces, were very, very supportive. Like, we camped, but it was so strange because a few days before getting arrested, we camped at a police station. Mm. They were like, yeah, come on in, guys, of course. And they thought it was amazing. And, you know, so it was very arbitrary how we got on well. And the police were actually the ones who showed us where to enter the river at the very beginning of the journey. So most of the time, got on very, very well with security forces. I think we just got unlucky with one particular set of people.
Mm. Okay, but and that was relatively close to the end of the journey. So it's
that was what made it even more frustrating. Mm. We were, when we look at the footage of us approaching Kapanda Dam, we were so happy because we knew that that was the that was one of the sort of final markers. And after the dam, that whole section afterwards, Alfie had pretty much already done. He'd either kayaked it with his brothers or he'd driven it to check it out in the 4x4. And the one thing we were really excited about was that's the section with no hippos.
Right.
So the dam is obviously a physical barrier that stopped the hippos from spreading to the lower sections of the river. And it was just, we were so excited to be going on a section that we knew was a lot safer than the section we'd just been on. So to kind of have that ripped away from us, or the threat of it being ripped away, was incredibly frustrating.
Right. But you made it. What was that like, finally hitting the Atlantic Ocean?
It felt incredible. The last day was very, very difficult though. For the last few kilometers, we had a really strong headwind. Really strong, and it was very, very choppy because of the wind, but also because it opened straight out into the ocean, so there's actually some big waves coming in. So yeah, the last few kilometers, you had to really dig deep to get there. And in the last 1 kilometer, we nearly sank. So it was a bit unfortunate because there's a lodge on the mouth of the River Kwanza called Kwanza Lodge, and that's where we'd arranged for some friends. Like, Alfie's girlfriend was down there, and some of our friends, they were kind of waiting on the finish line for us, basically stood on the jetty watching. And we're paddling as hard as we can, and I'm feeling water come into the kayak and get my feet wet. And I thought this would be just a really embarrassing place to sink, like the, within a few hundred meters of the finish line, essentially. And also a terrible place to sink because that's where bull sharks come in from the ocean and go hunting in the river. So, yeah, the last section was a bit of a worrying one.
What was there anything that you took away from the whole experience that, could you describe a kind of a transformation at all from, you know, pre and post that you took away from that experience?
I think the main thing, one thing that sort of stood out was that I think both Alfie and I were amazed by what your body will do if you just keep telling it to do stuff. So, you know, your mind gives up a lot quicker than your muscles do, or at least it tries to. And if you can just stay mentally strong, you're going to get it done. Essentially, we spent so much of that journey in so much discomfort, and there are so many points where we thought, well, this is it. Especially me. Alfie did slightly better than me, especially on the hiking sections. So many points where I just thought, I want to give up. This is so uncomfortable. My feet hurt so much. I know how much more I have to do after I finish this section and how much more discomfort there's going to be. I just can't do it. But just what you can achieve if you just kind of push through basically. You know, I think Alfie put it quite nicely when I was complaining about my feet for the umpteenth time. And he was just like, look, you know, there's nothing we can do about it, basically. Like, your feet are going to hurt and they're going to get worse. You know, they're going to get a lot worse throughout this journey, but it's not a mechanical problem with your legs. It's not like you snapped a ligament or a tendon. Your legs still work. It's just that it really hurts. So you've just got to kind of get your mind around that and just keep putting one foot in front of the other and just kind of deal with the pain, which at the time sounded quite unsympathetic, but I think that's exactly what I needed to hear. You just had to make a decision, you know, is this bad enough that I want to give up, or do I just need to shut up and get on with it? And in the end, I just shut up and get on with it, really.
Well, we're going to need to wrap it up soon, but this has been, there's so much there, and I wish we had, you know, 4 or 5 hours to explore this, but before we do, is there anything else around the journey that you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to discuss?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Would you do it again? I guess that's a question I was, or something similar. Is there a similar project on the horizon?
There is a similar project on the horizon, but that's a difficult one to answer in terms of would I do it again. Yeah. Having finished, it still slightly horrifies me. The level of exposure to risk when it came to the hippos, and how, I mean, it might, yeah, the level of luck we relied on to not get knocked out of the boat going past that many hippos, the level of stress we endured on a day-to-day basis, knowing that they're out there, basically we could hear them, we could often see them, and sometimes you couldn't see them. It was just the first two thirds of the journey were very, very risky from that hippo point of view.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would do it again, to be honest, because I don't think we realized quite how many hippos there were going to be. Mm. And quite how, you know, we had a lot of the river sections were very, very narrow. We had no choice but to basically go through big groups of hippos sometimes. There was no getting out. It was marshland on both sides. So we're incredibly exposed. I remember the very first set that we saw, we just paused and then there's complete silence. I'm like, well, what do we do now? Well, we have to keep going forward because what else can we do? We're not going to give up here. We're only a few days in. Mm-hmm. And every time we did that, you know, heart pulsing, terrified that you're going to feel a bump under the boat. And then, you know, it's a thin skin on a klepper because it's collapsible. So, you know, a tusk through the boat and it would have sunk. And then that would have been us swimming. You know, sometimes the river was very wide. It'd get up to a good sort of 100 meters wide. If we're in the middle of that and we sunk, that's a lot of swimming with a lot of hippos and crocodiles around you. So I'm not sure I'd do it again, or at least not in the way that we did it. I think it's a little bit risky. Perhaps Alfie would have a different answer than that.
Yeah.
But in terms of projects on the horizon, I think quite like to walk or kayak or some combination thereof. The longest river here in Madagascar, which is the Manroki River in the west of the country. It's a lot shorter than the Kwanza. I think it's only sort of, I say only, it's 400 or 500 kilometers long.
Right? Okay.
But it's in an extremely isolated part of the country. At the moment, it's full of crocodiles, but I don't think that's a big issue. I'm not sure they eat that many people. I don't think there are hippos, which is excellent news. But at the moment, the main logistical challenge there is that a lot of Madagascar's rural areas are quite lawless in terms of banditry.
Okay.
And a lot of the people that we've spoken to have said, actually, you know, you don't want to go out there and be isolated because you might get attacked and robbed at gunpoint. Mm. And there's not much to do to mitigate that risk apart from avoid the bandit areas, basically.
Right.
So I think we have to do some careful risk analysis on that one and see where the banditry has been happening exactly and how good an idea that would be. But yeah, that really stands out to me. I'd love to do that because, again, extremely isolated part of Africa, and it looks, again, like Kwanza. It looks like a doable journey.
Okay. Well, definitely. So it sounds like there's something on the horizon for you and Alfie, but you still need to work that out. So I'm sure some of my listeners will follow along and be interested in what those whatever that happens to be. And for my listeners, before we go, how can they best find the documentary, find you guys, learn a little bit more about what you've done, learn a little bit more about Halo, all of that good stuff?
They can find all of the details about our journey, including the 50-minute documentary, on our website, which is kayakthekwanza.com. Kwanza is spelled K-W-A-N-Z-A. Mm-hmm. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, and we have a book about our journey, which is being released by crowdfunding publisher Unbound at the moment. So if they go to unbound.com, they'll also be able to find and purchase either a digital version or a print version of the book.
Perfect.
Oh, and just a quick note about the book, sorry. We are actually donating 25% of the profits from the book to the Halo Trust to help them make Angola landmine-free by 2025.
Perfect. That's awesome. Oscar, this was great. I really, really enjoyed this, and I'm sure my listeners will get a lot out of it. Was there anything else before we sign off that you wanted to
mention? No, I think that's it.
Perfect. Thank you. Thanks so much, Oscar. Really, as I said, really appreciate this. I'll put all the links to everything in the show notes for my listeners, and wish you all the best with your future and adventures.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Ben.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. Check out the show notes as usual, and go to kayakthekwanza.com, where you can find Oscar and Alfie's wonderful film about their journey. And also have a look at the Halo Trust. It's tragic that there are so many landmines still in Angola, and there are a variety of ways in which you can donate and help. If you've got any feedback for me, you can send that to allthingsrisk@gmail.com. If you've not yet subscribed to the show, go to allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, and you can find all the ways in which you can get the show into your earbuds. We'll be back soon. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.